You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM, all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations, all across the Americas, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. And many thanks for that. More people listen to or watch the Tom Hartman Program and more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. And we're very, very grateful to start this year, third year in a row with that status, ninth year on the air, and very pleased to have you with us. Welcome back to, or welcome to the new year, our first live show of the new year. And I'm honored to have with me to start the new year, Professor Robert Reich, Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, and might I add, one of the finest cabinet officers in my lifetime in any administration, and the author of the latest book, the author of his latest book, Aftershock, The New Economy and America's Future, which is now out in paperback. You can read his writings in his blog and commentary over at Robert Reich, R-E-I-C-H.org. Robert Reich, welcome back to the program.
Well, good morning, John. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, and very nice to have you with us.
2012, by the way, is going to be a better one than 2011.
Yeah, yeah, if the Mayans are wrong.
I hope that they're wrong. They haven't been always right.
You're right. They're not around anymore.
Yeah. Well,
you know, back when Hillary Clinton was first selected as Secretary of State, and decided to jump into that position on this program, and numerous times over the years I've commented that she and Joe Biden should swap places, and I've been making this kind of running joke with every Republican I get on the show for the last 6 months or so, who's going to be the guy who's going to be Marco Rubio's running mate. And you codified these into this brilliant column on yesterday, New Year's predictions, and I thought, my God, great minds think alike.
Well, Tom, you know, if you and I both feel the same way about the future, it's bound to happen.
And Would it be so?
Political predictions, like economic forecasts and weather forecasts, are almost bound to be wrong. Yep. I think astrology is more accurate than any of them. But I do think that there's something to the idea of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden swapping places. It makes sense for Obama in terms of galvanizing the Democratic base, getting them more excited. I mean, so many people are kind of disenchanted, to put it mildly, with the Obama administration because of his cave-ins to the Republicans and very centrist, if not right-of-center, approaches. Now, Hillary Clinton may not be that much better in terms of, a kind of left-of-center or progressive voice, but nevertheless, her presence on the ticket would generate some excitement. She is the most admired woman in America. She has the experience, obviously. She has a fairly good record, although obviously we can pick faults with it, as Secretary of State. It makes a lot of sense.
Well, and I think there's the pugnacious factor, and I realize that's not a word that's usually applied to women in a flattering way, but I mean it that way. I mean it, you know, as a positive. We've seen, and I think that on the Republican side, in fact, one of the things that we've seen, and I don't think this is unique to Republicans, I think this is an American quality and maybe just human nature, that people want a fighter in their leaders. And Hillary Clinton is somebody who knows how to take names and kick ass and has done that and is known, you know, as somebody who will fight. And Barack Obama has, up until recently, been seen more as a compromiser and, okay, let's find a middle road and let's shake hands and be nice to each other. And I think that he needs that, you know, on his ticket. And Joe Biden's, you know, good at speaking out, but he hasn't been the fighter, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's a matter of both temperament and approach. I think Obama is such a conciliator. And even stylistically, I mean, you listen to speeches that are supposed to be very fiery speeches. I mean, if you read that speech from 3 weeks ago that he gave in Kansas, the most populist progressive speech I think he's given of his entire presidency, it reads better than he actually delivered it. He delivered it in his very, you know, typical mild-mannered fashion.
Yeah.
Now, again, I think you're absolutely right. Hillary will add that kind of element of fire to the ticket.
Yeah. And now I've actually raised this on this program and also on our TV show over the last year, probably a half a dozen times with various Republican consult or Democratic consultants, rather. Do you think that this is possible, including one person who was inside the administration who was very offended by that? You know, but
was it Joe Biden?
I think it wasn't a Biden. the idea of Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden swapping places, and to a person, their response to me has been, well, Hillary is has made it very clear that she's kind of at the end of her political career, that she loves being Secretary of State, but when she's done with that, she fully intends to retire and do the kind of good work that her husband is doing or that Jimmy Carter is doing, that sort of thing. Or maybe even just retire quietly as George W. Bush has done. What do you think about that?
Well, it's possible. Look, everybody's different, and that's certainly possible. But if the party and the president and a lot of Americans put pressure on her, she may very well change her mind. She's only 64 years old. Now, I can say as somebody who's 65 years old, that 64 is not old.
Yeah.
64 is actually relatively young, and she has a lot of vitality, as she's shown. I've known her for, well, since she was 20 years old.
Wow.
I can tell you, she's got a, you know, she is a fighter. She has a lot of spirit. You know, she is not as much, I don't think it's, she's not as much of a progressive, Tom, as I think you would characterize yourself, or I would like to characterize myself. But she, I think, would add significantly to the ticket, and I think she'd take it. That's my judgment. I have no inside information at all.
If we could shift gears for just a moment and maybe get to your book, Aftershock, the Next Economy in America's Future, in the 2 minutes or so we have left here. What are your thoughts about where the economy is at right now and the blowback to the economy and to the failure to radically change things in the first few years of the Obama administration? That blowback's most visible symptom, I think, right now being Occupy Wall Street and arguably the Tea Party.
Well, first of all, there are two separate economies. There is the economy of the top 1%. I mean, the corporate economy, the Wall Street economy, the economy reported on by the Wall Street Journal. That economy is in fairly good shape. I mean, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up for the year. Corporate profits are huge. American corporations are sitting on more than $1 trillion of cash. They're quite happy. Globalization has helped them, and they are doing well around the globe. But the average American is not doing well. Median wages are down, lower than they were. Unemployment is still stuck very, very high. The unemployment report was slightly better than expected last time around was because so many people exited from the workforce, and many people are too discouraged even to look for work. I wish Obama had done more. I mean, I and others advocated for a bigger stimulus package, and I wish at every turn he had fought Republicans harder. What I get back from the administration, and it's not altogether wrong, is that the Republicans have never been as united and also as determined to block a president as they have been under Obama, and he did the best he could. That's not going to, in the election, doing the best you can and still having unemployment up there at almost 9% or 8.6% is not going to win you a lot of votes. But if the direction of the economy come election day is good, if things look like they're getting better, then he is going to be in much better position.
Yeah, so we'll see how this all plays out. Robert Reich, robertreich.org, and his new book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Robert Reich, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always good talking with you. We'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and our number 866-987-THOM. Oh, and up next, John Nichols is going to check in with us. Some interesting stuff on the Democratic side in Utah.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Did I say Utah? Iowa. Excuse me. We'll be right back from Iowa.
Keep me in mind. Somewhere down the road you might get lonely. Keep me in mind.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. John Nichols with TheNation.com, The Nation magazine, the Washington reporter, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, is on the line with us from Iowa, John?
I am from Iowa, my friend.
So you are occupying Iowa, and I know I've been, Tim Carpenter has been CCing me all these things on everything that's been going on out there with the Occupy Iowa on the Democratic side movement. Tell me about this.
Well, that's the important thing to recognize. One of the fundamental realities of what's going on in Iowa is that this is not just Republican caucuses. We are also having Democratic caucuses tonight, and they're going to be a big deal. There's going to be thousands of people who come out and caucus, either for Barack Obama or perhaps for uncommitted, as some groups like Iowa Healthcare Not Warfare have advocated as a way of sending a message to the president. There's also going to be many other activities. Some progressives will go even to the Republican caucuses and caucus for Ron Paul. In addition, there will be efforts by various groups, including Move to Amend, to pass resolutions at the caucuses supporting an amendment to the Constitution with the hopes of overturning the Citizens United ruling, or at least tempering its worst effects. And Iowa Citizens for Community Involvement, Iowa CCI, which is a terrific progressive populist group, has proposed a list of resolutions to be introduced at Democratic and Republican caucuses seeking to shift the platforms of the major parties on a host of economic and democracy issues.
Wow, a lot going on. Now,
it really is.
Now with the Republican caucuses, everybody basically writes down a name on a blank piece of paper, then somebody adds them all up and they come up with the vote. With the Democratic caucuses, my recollection from last time around is that they would get together in a room and people would stand in various corners representing various candidates or positions. Is that how it's going to work? First of all, verify that I'm right about the Republicans. And with regard to the Democrats, how are they going to work it out this time? Because, you know, we already have a candidate. He's sitting in the White House.
Yeah, terrific questions on both sides. The Republicans will do basically a glorified straw poll early in their caucuses. Writing down the name on a piece of paper or voting on a ballot does not choose delegates. What that does is just send a signal of sentiment. It's a gauging of how people feel about the candidate. And so that will be what's reported tonight in the news, although it won't in any sense give you a reading on the number of delegates who will actually be won, because the delegate selection process actually comes after that straw poll.
And it's done by the party, basically?
Well, it's done by activists who will stick around, choose delegates to a county convention, then the county convention will choose delegates to a district convention. It's a process that goes on over a number of months, and ultimately the party establishment usually does put its imprint on things.
Yeah.
So Ron Paul could win tonight and still not get all the delegates, or even a substantial portion.
Right. I think it's a foregone conclusion that the Republican establishment is going to do everything they can to make sure that Ron Paul is not the nominee. There's not going to be a Barry Goldwater moment in the Republican Party this time.
No, and the structure in Iowa allows for that sort of intervention.
Okay.
And on the Democratic side, it is a more smoldy Democratic process. People do divide up into the corners of the room, and that process does begin the delegate selection. So it's different on the Democratic side. But it's going to be complex tonight on the Democratic side, and I've heard concerns expressed by a lot of folks, some of whom are backers of President Obama, some of whom are not. But they share a concern that the caucuses will not really be traditional caucuses, but more of a kind of a pep rally for the president. The president will be streaming video into these rallies across the state. And that certainly is right. Nobody objects to that. But there is some concern about whether dissident voices will be heard. And we'll see how it plays tonight. I think in some counties of Iowa, Johnson County in particular, which is the Iowa City area, there's been quite a bit of organizing by the Healthcare Not Warfare folks who really want to send a signal at the caucuses about the need for very different priorities within the Democratic Party.
Right.
So we'll watch Johnson County in particular to see if there's a significant dissent.
Right, and this is the part, and really this is the process. This is not an anti-Obama process. This is the process of becoming what Plato referred to as the mob that pushes the politicians. what I'd say is the parade that the politicians want to get out in front of, the wind behind their back, whatever, the thing that will move them to allow President Obama to act on his more progressive instincts, knowing that he has a large base and a lot of people have his back, or if we're misreading those instincts, force him into those positions, basically, yeah. Or push him into those positions.
Yeah, I happen to kind of be on the latter side. I think that the popular pressure makes good presidents better. It makes bad presidents acceptable.
Yeah.
And so I think it's healthy to have it no matter what.
It's necessary. It's the only thing that works.
Yeah, it is. And one of the encouraging things is that there's a real movement here in Iowa urging folks to go to both Democratic and Republican caucuses to caucus for uncommitted. Mm. To say, you know, we object to the failure of both parties to address some fundamental issues. And so we want to,
right.
You know, at least try to send a signal. Why that's important, there's two places where that's important. First, you'll see whether you get a significant uncommitted crowd coming out of the Democratic caucuses. But also, that could be a factor at Republican caucuses. Michelle Bachmann is now polling so badly that some folks are talking about the prospect that she could get beaten by uncommitted.
Wow.
That would be actually a pretty significant signal.
It would, especially since she won the straw poll just a few months ago.
Yeah, it ain't going so good for her. I was out with her yesterday,
uh-huh.
And there were many, many more Ron Paul backers on the street than there were Michelle Bachmann backers.
Yeah, it's the whole Ron Paul phenomena. We're going to have to do an entire show on that one of these days. It's become like a cult. John,
yeah, it's a physically engaged support level, let's just say that.
Yeah, absolutely. John Nichols with The Nation. com. John, thank you very much for the report. Always great talking.
Always good to be on with you, Tom.
Thank you, John. Bye.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour, more with the news and your calls right after this. True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and
I was gonna go to class before I got high.
Oh, it's our I Got High alert, yes. Two people who pulled into the McDonald's drive-through in Western Illinois at 2 o'clock in the morning last Wednesday are, I don't know if they're still sitting in jail, but police officers were not amused, neither were the people at McDonald's. A 19-year-old man and a 21-year-old woman have been released from the Knox County Jail after showing up naked. What are you doing at 2 o'clock in the morning in the McDonald's drive? That's why we said, you know, get high, blind munchies, McDonald's. I don't know. I guess the question is, were they ordering the fried pies, or were they, you know, anyway. amazing. The Occupy Wall Street movement tried to reoccupy Zuccotti Park over the weekend, by the way. In fact, Louise and I watched that on New Year's Eve, that live stream, rather than the ball dropping. Watch them take the park, and then several hours later they lost the park. Natural gas fracking has caused an earthquake in Ohio and has put some fracking on hold. We'll see how that plays out. And one of the most important things, I think, in the news today is that the Supreme Court in the state of Montana said, this is the state Supreme Court, said we are not going to uphold, how do I say this? They said that the Citizens United decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which says that corporations are people and money is speech, and allows for these 527s, these super PACs, the PACs and super PACs, and even Mike Huckabee has now come out and said that this is like snipers from behind the trees, you know, these super PACs, because anonymous people can just pour enormous amounts of money in and take people out politically. Newt Gingrich is complaining about them in Iowa right now. The Supreme Court of Montana was presented with a case. They had a 100-year-old law on the books that regulated campaign spending by corporations. And, of course, the corporation sued and said, you know, Citizens United has pretty much settled this. The United States Supreme Court has said, we're people. You got to get this law off the books here in Montana, so because there's an election coming and we want to participate. And the state Supreme Court in Montana said, sorry, federally, the U.S. Supreme Court can say that corporations are people and money is speech. But when it comes to state elections or what happens in our state, and there's going to be some serious parsing of this Montana state Supreme Court decision. And in fact, as we speak, we're looking for from Montana who actually has some serious expertise on this, how this is parsed out. But basically, the Montana folks are saying no. Actually, in fact, we're going to have David Cobb is going to be on here in the next hour to talk about this. The Montana folks are saying no. The Montana Supreme Court, state Supreme Court. In Montana, corporations are not people. Money is not speech. So I find that fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Brent, Roanoke, Virginia. Hey, Brent, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'd like to suggest to others that are concerned about the impact of the Citizens United case that the steps of the Supreme Court is a logical place to occupy.
I will be occupying those steps on January 20th.
January 20th?
At noon. Eastern time. Yes, I will be there.
I'll be with you.
Okay, great. I look forward
to
it. Thanks a lot,
bye-bye.
Brent. Yeah, there is nationwide the Occupy MoveToAmend.org is doing a nationwide Occupy the Federal Courts on January 20th, and I'll be at the Supreme Court, and others will be in other places. And this is not a I'll be there to get arrested thing. It's going to be, you know, we're going to be there to give a speech and make a statement, but, you know, that's pretty much it. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to a comment that you made about leadership and democracy. Something that I think should be repeated almost every day is that George Bush once said that he was the decider,
right,
the omnipotent leader. You know, he made the decisions for us, and I think this was on I might be wrong about this, but it was on the lead up to the Iraq War, and there was by no means, opinion was not entirely behind him in that,
right,
but they were going to lead us into a war no matter what, and I think, it's been a terrible thing because of the lives that have been lost, number one, and then the money that was spent. You know, probably it'll be over $1 trillion.
Probably it'll be over $3 trillion when you figure an entire generation of wounded soldiers.
Yeah, and you know, just the idea of, you know, the president saying I'm the decider. I thought,
right,
what is this? Is this,
yeah,
Joe Stalin or is this Hitler? Or, you know, these are the kind of things that people say in totalitarian governments, and you know, there was plenty of demonstrations. There were people in the Pentagon that said, no, there were no weapons of mass destruction. This is a big mistake. We don't need to do this.
The United Nations was saying that. The United Nations arms inspectors were saying that. The IAEA was saying that.
And one person, one arrogant person, you know, who thought that he could just ram this down the rest of our throats said, I'm the decider. Who was this person and why was he allowed to say that? Why did he get away with that by the press? And besides which, it's not very good English, especially for somebody who is Harvard, Yale educated.
Back in the 60s, it was not uncommon for, particularly at elite universities, but I certainly saw it in Michigan. It was not uncommon to hire people to go to class for you and to write your papers for you. In fact, one of my best friends started a company selling, you know, writing papers for other people. So whether George Bush ever actually showed up for class, I remember in the election of 2000, they were trying to find people who could remember seeing him at class at Yale, or at Harvard, rather, for his MBA, and nobody could remember him showing up. So who knows? But the bigger point here, I think, and the one that you're identifying so well, is that we don't elect leaders. We elect representatives. But even more important than that, when somebody tries to be a leader in the United States, if they're not jumping out in front of the big parade, if they're not leading with the people behind them, they're going to make terrible decisions because generally the majority of the people are right. And by the way, we had over 1 million people in the streets. We had more people in the streets in the lead up to the Iraq War than in the history of the world for anything. even, you know, dwarfing the civil rights demonstrations and the anti-Vietnam demonstrations. In the history of the world, worldwide, there were more people in the streets opposing one single thing. But you go back to 1998, and Jacob, you've got that Cindy Sheehan clip when she was testifying before Congress. Maybe we can play this. George W. Bush in 1998, before when he was thinking about running for president, his mother and father hired an old family friend by the name of Mickey Herskowitz, a fairly famous author down in Texas, ghostwriter, to ghostwrite his autobiography, A Charge to Keep. And Herskowitz interviewed Bush for many, many hours on tape. And he turned in the first draft. They didn't, it wasn't suck up enough. And so they replaced him with a second ghostwriter who finished the book. But Mickey Herskowitz did the first draft. And then he had a conversation with, I believe it was Robert Perry. This is a matter of public record. It's easy to find. In which he quoted George Bush. Now, keep in mind, this was 1998 or 1999, before he was even selected by the Supreme Court to be president of the United States. George W. Bush had decided already he was going to invade Iraq. And why? So that he could accomplish what he had tried to do in 1977 when he unsuccessfully ran for Congress from Texas on the single platform of privatizing Social Security, which, as you'll recall, was what he tried to do right after the 2004 election. Anyhow, here's this clip. This is Cindy Sheehan testifying under oath before Congress about Mickey Herskowitz.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
It looks like, there you go. And then she goes on to say, it looks like my son Casey was doomed before he, and which is true. Bush came into office. In fact, you know, one of his cabinet officers wrote a book in which he said that several of them have now said that the very first cabinet meeting that they had in January of 2001, after Bush was installed into office, at the very first topic that George Bush brought up was, how do we invade Iraq? And everybody was like, what are you talking about? You know, what does that have to do with anything? This was 9 months before 9/11. And Dick Cheney was put in charge. So any, without going into the whole long rant, because I'm going to hit a time break here in about a half a minute. But the point is that when a president or anybody in a leadership position goes off on something that is not the will of the people for their own ulterior motives. And in this case, George Bush knew that wartime presidents get political capital. So he thought by being a wartime president, in this case, Iraq, that he would get enough political capital that he could privatize Social Security. That when a politician or a leader leads in a direction that the people don't want to be led, they end up being a pariah. And that's why you will not hear a Republican candidate in Iowa mention the name George W. Bush. He is like Voldemort. He is the name that shall not be spoken. Why? Because he did not lead by being pushed from behind. He went off on his own direction. You don't do that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And that's why it's so crucial that we get out there and say to our politicians, this is the direction we want you to go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Devon, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too. Thank you.
Well, back to what you were saying earlier, the Aristotle or Socrates or Plato, whoever it was, I've always heard it said that when the people lead, the leaders will follow.
That's perfect.
There you go. So, but that assumes that the leaders, the representatives, are doing the will of the people.
Yes.
And it seems that they're really doing the will of the corporations. So now when the people lead, they get tear gassed and arrested. And, you know, it doesn't seem to be working that way anymore.
I agree. And that And by the way, we've been there before. In fact, we've been there ever since the founding of this country. The first attempt of the people to lead and change the politicians was the abolition movement. And by the 1830s, you had John Quincy Adams, the son of John Adams, after he left the White House, going back to the House of Representatives just so he could fight against slavery. When they wrote the Constitution, they thought that they wrote into the Constitution, and you can read it in the original draft, that slavery ended in 1808. That was the last year of Jefferson's presidency. He tried to make it happen. He was unsuccessful. He wrote in his in a letter to, I believe it was James Madison in 1828, as he was an elderly man at that point, he wrote, he was talking about the Missouri Compromise and how slavery was continuing. And he said, I am now on this bark, was the word, but he meant canoe, to the other shore. In other words, he was about to die. And he said, my my nation is about to tear itself in half over this issue of slavery, which we thought we had decided, 30 years ago. He said, my only consolation is that I shall not live to weep over it.
I mean, I really think they decided to ban the importation of any new slaves, which
yes.
only drove up the value internally of the people who were already enslaved here, and really created had a snowball effect in creating a market in people.
You're right.
That was pretty disgusting.
You're right.
That I think.
You're right.
So, but the point is, when we the people get out and try to tell the leaders, hey, look, put these mangsters in jail, we're put in jail.
Yeah.
So,
no, but my point is, from the abolition movement, through the suffrage movement, through the for and against prohibition movement, through the modern civil rights movement and the modern women's rights movements, in every case, the people got out and tried to lead. They got tear gassed. They got the anti-Vietnam War movement. They got tear gassed. They got hassled. They got fought against. The old Gandhi, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. And I think that with regard to corporate power right now, and frankly with regard to governmental power, the president, for example, signing this defense appropriation bill with his signing statement
right.
that says, well, I'm not going to, arrest anybody, but future presidents might be able to. A lot of people are very horrified and disappointed by that. And
he said he would veto that bill, Tom.
That's
so
right.
Where's the leaders following the people there? I mean,
well, again, I believe that if the military-industrial complex did not have the economic power, which in this country now, as a result of a series of Supreme Court decisions going back to the 19th century, translates into political power. If the military-industrial complex did not have that economic and political power, that the president would not have made that decision the way that he did. And frankly, 80% of the stuff that goes through Congress wouldn't be going through Congress the way it does.
And when the Constitution was drafted and the power in enabling the slave trade, in allowing the people in the South to, in essence, co-opt the vote of every slave as three-fifths of a person, we gave power to the people who had money because money was running the system. King Cotton, came to be running the system. It's
yeah.
always been about placating the moneyed. So, it seems like there comes a time to...
There's nuance in that three-fifths argument that probably is way beyond the scope of this conversation.
Sure.
But as you know, the population, what the southern states were trying to do, because they had a large slave population and a small white population, and in the southern states they were not allowing the slaves to vote. They were not allowing blacks to vote. Blacks were voting in Delaware. They were voting in Rhode Island. They were voting in New Hampshire. They were voting in New York, but not in the southern states. Until after the Civil War, Congress had basically followed the 10th Amendment and let states make that decision. And so the southern states, particularly Georgia, said, we will not join the Union if we're not going to have enough members of Congress, because the number of members of Congress is based on population, unless you
right.
count the African Americans in our state, or at least some of the African Americans in our state, so that we'll have more members of the House of Representatives. And the people
exactly
and the people from the northern states,
because it was agrarian and
right.
rural,
and the people from the northern states said,
one-to-one.
Right, the people from the northern states said, hey, you're not going to let them vote, we're not going to count them and give you representatives. And the people from the southern states
right.
said, we're not going to let them vote, but you have to count all of them, or we're not going to join. And the compromise
right.
that they came up with was, on the assumption that eventually slavery was going to end, was that for the moment they would count three-fifths of the people who were not able to vote in the South for purposes of congressional representation, And then, you know, eventually, I mean, keep in mind, Jefferson, the first piece of legislation Jefferson introduced when he was in the House of Burgesses, when he was like 23, 24 years old in the state of Virginia, the first piece of legislation he introduced was to end slavery in Virginia. And he was so punished for that that the Virginia House of Burgesses passed legislation that if he tried to free his slaves, they would be seized by the state for 2 years.
Well, and, sure. I mean, Virginia has a long history of,
yeah,
eventually, if you could.
But I mean, many of these,
the money people made out on the Constitution, Tom, the
yes,
people who,
yes,
you know, they got to count their slaves as 3/5 of a person, thereby wielding power. I mean,
thereby having more representation in the House of Representatives.
Right. So
yeah,
it's, you know, it's always been about the money and who's going to win. And
that's right.
You know,
and that's why we have to get the money out of it.
Well, I agree. I agree. But, you know, if the leaders are locking up the people for standing up and saying what they want done, which is, you know, put the banksters in jail, then,
right,
you know, there's got to be a, I don't know, there's got to be a,
I think if we persist, I really, Devonna, I really believe if we persist as, you know, I mean, Susan B. Anthony didn't see it in her lifetime. Many of the civil rights, many of the abolitionists didn't see it in their lifetimes. But I think we will. I think if we persist that this will happen, I think that there is a groundswell now to roll back Citizens United and take back the Supreme Court. But we'll see. Devon, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Breaking news. Well, it's not breaking news. It was actually last night. An interview with ABC News. Rick Santorum says that states should have the right to outlaw birth control. Yeah. In fact, he had said last year, he said, one of the things I will talk about that no president has talked about before, I think the dangers of contraception in this country. It's not okay. It's a license to do things in the sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be. I want to share with you in a little bit about Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965 and how things used to be. But Santorum is like, you know, on the uptick in Iowa right now. And let's get the latest on how the voting side of this. We got a report from John Nichols in the previous hour about, you know, what's going on the ground and how the candidates are stacking up, as it were, falling apart, or the wacky positions. Let's talk about the actual process. Gingrich says that while Acorn, this is incredible, while Acorn committed massive voter fraud, his massive voter fraud is just a mistake. Brad Friedman is the expert on all things voting. He is the editor and publisher of bradblog.com and is with us. Brad, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here. Happy New Year to you, my friend.
Thank you. And the same to you, too. And in fact, I see we don't have you on Skype. I'm surprised. What's the story here? Gingrich committed voter fraud?
Well, Gingrich committed voter fraud if you consider what Acorn did to be voter fraud. And then it actually wasn't Acorn at all. It was Acorn's handful of workers for Acorn. You'll recall that Republicans, and in fact Newt Gingrich himself for years have been decrying that Acorn had committed voter fraud. And they would do this every time one of Acorn workers were found to have submitted fraudulent registrations.
Right.
Now, in the case of Acorn, they actually checked all of those registrations, discovered the fraud, and turned them in to officials and turned in the folks who committed the fraud, because it was Acorn themselves who was being defrauded by these workers. In
right.
the case of
So Acorn never actually submitted fraudulent registrations to the government.
Well, they actually did submit them, but they would be flagged as fraudulent because by law, Acorn has to turn in any registration that anybody signs
and turns in
to one of their users.
Okay. So now, in the case of Newt Gingrich trying to get on the ballot in Virginia, he turned in 11,500 signatures. He was required to turn in at least 10,000 registered Republicans, and
And what he now claims is that 1,500 of those signatures were fraudulent. He claims, he told a voter this in Iowa, it's caught on videotape, he said that 1,500 of those signatures were fraudulent, were submitted by just one guy on their campaign. Notably, he doesn't give the name of this guy. And because of those fraudulent signatures, he did not have enough signatures to get on the ballot, the primary ballot, in his home state of Virginia this year.
Right, to hit that 10,000 mark.
Yeah, exactly.
And now,
his campaign, apparently, unlike Acorn, his campaign did not bother to check those 1,500 signatures before turning them in to make sure to find out if they were legitimate or not. So if you use the Fox News Republican Party standard that they have been using for years to declare that Acorn had committed voter fraud, when in fact they never, ever did, then by that very same standard, Newt Gingrich himself committed massive voter fraud in the state of Virginia, and worse case than Acorn ever did.
Right, or at least his campaign.
And that's right.
And probably this is because he was paying people to collect signatures, which Acorn...
They were paying people to collect signatures, but I think more importantly, you know, up until this year, the Republican Party in Virginia never bothered to check those signatures to make sure that they were legitimate. They would just rubber stamp the process. The parties themselves are allowed to determine whether the signatures turned in, whether there were enough signatures turned in or not. But due to a lawsuit this year, the Republican Party said, you know what,
right,
we better check these signatures.
So now the way Fox is dealing with this basically is when Acorn was submitting about 1.5 or 6% fraudulent signatures that were flagged as fraudulent, do not use these, we caught these, that was called voter fraud. But when Newt Gingrich submitted about 15% of his total as fraudulent signatures, did not flag them, did not identify them, and in fact tried to get on the ballot based on them, that was not voter fraud. That was a mistake.
According to Newt's own words to this woman, he said, oh, no, that was, quote, just a mistake. And that same mistake when Acorn made it, was massive voter fraud, according to them. And according to Newt, who himself back in, I believe it was 2009, in an op-ed in the Washington Examiner, actually charged that Acorn had committed massive voter fraud, when in fact they never had, but he was basing it on these reports, this handful of workers who had turned in fraudulent registrations, who had been flagged by Acorn themselves.
You know, the bigger picture here, Brad, is that the Republicans have been using this canard of voter fraud for years and years and years as an excuse to prevent people from voting, to reduce the number of people who can vote, knowing that if they can reduce the number of people who vote, they will first and foremost probably reduce the most disenfranchised among us, the poorest, the people who have to work on Tuesdays, the elderly, students, people who typically tend to vote Democratic, and that will work to their advantage, and they use this to take apart Acorn, which was a very effective organization for registering to vote people who were largely in urban areas, people of color, people who were poor. And really, that's what this is all about, isn't it? I mean,
yeah, that's exactly what this is all about. And I should add, by the way, that there is no evidence, none, that any fraudulent vote was ever cast vis-a-vis one of those bad Acorn registrations in any election at anywhere at any time. None.
Right.
So when they say Acorn committed voter fraud, it is a complete and utter lie. Not a single, Mickey Mouse never voted.
Right.
Dick Tracy never voted. Complete lie.
Right. But Mickey Mouse did vote 1,500 times for Newt Gingrich.
Apparently so. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Now,
so
now, to underscore that, in Iowa tonight, where the Republican Party themselves set their own rules, where they can have any rules they want. In fact, they are having an election where no photo ID is required to either vote or to register for the first time and vote right there and then at the polls.
Wow.
So either they're in favor of voter fraud in their own election tonight, in their own caucuses tonight, or they know the truth, which is that polling place voter fraud is incredibly rare, doesn't happen, and they are smart enough not to turn away their own voters in a Republican caucus, but in an election where Democrats are participating, That's a different story entirely, and those people must be stopped from voting.
Right, although they are starting to have second thoughts now about the Ron Paul possibility that the Ron Paul people will show up and steal the crown from Mitt Romney.
Steal it by getting to cast their legal vote, you mean?
That's right, yes. Steal it would be their phrase, not mine. Win.
Exactly.
Yeah, and in fact, they've got a whole system there that will prevent that from happening, even if
it's extraordinarily
Ron Paul gets the most votes.
What's going on in Iowa? I mean, the no photo ID is necessary. You can register on the same day and vote on the same day. And, by the way, they're using hand-counted paper ballots at the polling place. All of these things are things that Republicans have fought against in all of the other elections, including in Iowa itself, where the Republicans in the state house tried to pass a photo ID measure earlier this year.
Amazing.
Unbelievable.
No photo ID, no voting machines, voting on paper. Incredible. Incredible.
Yep.
They've got to figure it out. Brad Friedman. Brad, thank you very much for being with us.
Always my pleasure.
Great talking with you. Bradblog.com, by the way. Brad's blog, where you'll find an enormous amount of great information about what's going on with elections around the country.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, I mentioned in the last hour the Montana Supreme Court and Citizens United. It's going to get really amazing. Stick around. David Cobb will be here.
Saw you getting across the sky.
Well, speaking of the sky, the big sky state is Montana, and news from Montana. David Cobb on the line with us. David is an attorney, a spokesperson for MoveToAmend.org, and the National Projects Director of Democracy Unlimited, also the Green Party candidate for president some years back. David, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure to be on this program.
Glad to have you with us. David, Montana... Yeah, I read the news story. You're an attorney, and you know this stuff inside out. So I wanted to turn to you and find out the real scoop here. Montana has had a lot of books going back to the last century. We had a caller earlier say it was the Copper Kings ran the state, and it was to keep corporate money from corrupting their politicians. And the Montana Supreme Court just ruled something about Citizens United in the U.S. Supreme Court. Tell us about it.
Well, it is true. Your caller was absolutely correct. The law prohibiting corporate expenditures in Montana elections was created in 1908 as a direct result of the fights that had been taking place against the Copper Kings and other mining interests in Montana. It was over 100 years old. And what to me is most exciting, interesting, is the fact that the Montana Supreme Court basically did a nuanced approach around Citizens United. The decision was very explicit and very clear that says, okay, we're not going to take on Citizens United head on because that's the U.S. Supreme Court and we're the Montana Supreme Court. However, we're going to say that Montana law, by applying the doctrine of strict scrutiny, we will show a compelling state interest that demonstrates that this law falls within the restrictions that are still available to us under Citizens United. And then they went through the litany of history of how it has been the case, not only for that law, but they called the seamless transition between corporate America and government,
right,
where government ends and corporate America begins. They said, quote, the transition is seamless and overlapping.
Yeah, they basically called out the Supreme Court on a horrible ruling.
Tom, what you're seeing in this decision is you're right, it's calling out. On the schoolyard, what we would see is that this is a showdown.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing here is the rising reaction, the resistance, the people's resistance that is playing out, not only to Citizens United, but let's be clear, let's go deeper, Tom. The concept that a corporation has inherent constitutional rights, the concept that money is speech, these are court-created doctrines. They're not in the supreme law of the land or our U.S. Constitution. They don't exist anywhere.
And they have never been passed by any legislature or signed into law by any governor or president. In fact, the opposite.
In fact, you're exactly right, Tom. The opposite is that throughout most of our history, you've seen political leaders questioning that up until the last 20 years, quite frankly.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're seeing is a people's movement that is getting larger, stronger, and better organized to overturn not just Citizens United, but to overturn the legal doctrines of corporate personhood, the doctrine that money is political speech. We overturn those two doctrines, Tom, and we have an entirely new playing field that we can carry on the experiment of the American democracy.
Right. We get our country back. And those and the mantra is corporations are not people, money is not speech. And now, did the Montana Supreme Court, there was a doctrine that you identified. Is that a subset of the 10th Amendment of states' rights? I mean, were they claiming states' rights, or were they or
well, it paralleled. The answer is yes, they're claiming states' rights, but they didn't rest on the 10th Amendment, which is of course the states' right amendment. What they said is in the majority opinion, they said, look, the Supreme Court said that there is a compelling state interest, that political expenditure can be regulated, but only with a, quote, compelling state interest. And as a lawyer, what that means is you have to now prove through what's known as strict scrutiny test, that there is no other way to address whatever the problem is. And if so, then the legislation will stand. The Montana court has done is to basically take up that challenge and said there is clear, compelling evidence that corporate monies are quid pro quo corruption in Montana. We are interpreting Montana state law. So they used the 10th Amendment in parallel, but they also took on directly the Supreme Court of the United States argument that money is not inherently corrupting in the political process,
right.
And they took it on four square.
So this takes it all the way back to Buckley.
Oh, absolutely, and even beyond Buckley, because, of course, there was 100 years of legal jurisprudence of forbidding corporate expenditures in money in most states as well.
Right.
Now, to me, what we're seeing is the fight, the political fight playing out in the courts, and I think, bluntly, the Citizens United case is an example of the arrogance of great power. They have overreached. You're seeing now constitutional amendments being proposed. The Move to Amend coalition is growing across the country. I mean, I watch and listen to your show, Tom, and see how often your callers and your blogs are lit up on corporate personhood.
Oh, yeah.
The Supreme Court, in a very real way, has actually done us a favor by making clear the connections between corporate America, our federal government, and the court system.
Yeah, they took the mask off, basically, in Citizens United. And now, and then Karl Rove came out and said, oh, and I'm going to raise a couple $100 million and influence the elections, and I'm not even going to tell you where the money's coming from. And now the mask is really off. And then people like Stephen Colbert are doing a great job of satirizing it so that the average person understands what's going on. And in fact, Bernie's going
to
be on his show tonight.
To tell the truth on mainstream television.
Yeah, and Bernie Sanders, I believe, is going to be on Stephen Colbert's show tonight. Bernie does a gig on our show, you know, every Friday, has for 7 years, about his constitutional amendment. And you know, there's a bunch of different dueling constitutional amendments out there, and they'll all recycle with the next Congress. But we really need to say corporations are not people, money is not speech. End of discussion, and you can find out more about it at movetoamend.org. David
Cobb. That's right. And we'll be at the U.S. Supreme Court on January 20th. Tom, I know you'll be joining us.
Yes.
I hear the music in the background.
Yep.
We'll be back on this program. Thanks for what you do for America.
You betcha. And I'll see you on January 20th on the steps of the Supreme Court at noon. Thank you, David Cobb.
You bet.
We'll talk to you soon.
All right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
See, this is what I've been talking about. If the movement gets big enough, if the mob shows up, the politicians will follow. It's beginning.
That but my book was sent, but now nobody knows exactly where it went. I lost my book. It isn't fair. I took a stand, but did anybody care? Then I lost my book. Now do you know where did my ballot go?
I hope we don't have a lot of those concerns, as we did in the 2004 election, the 2000 election, 2008 election, goes. Well, we'll see. Rick Santorum, I promised you. Excuse me, I promised you a commentary on this. Pardon my sneeze. Rick Santorum has come out and said that states should have the right to outlaw birth control and that he, if elected president, this is not abortion, we're talking birth control, that he, as president, well, here's his exact quote. One of the things I will talk about that no president has talked about before is, I think, the dangers of contraception in this country. It is not okay. It is a license to do things in a sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be. End of quote from Rick Santorum. So Santorum's taking the position that, A, the only reason to have sex is to produce babies. B, that should only happen between married people, although he doesn't say that in this statement, but he has on numerous other occasions. Those married people being one man and one woman, which is not biblical marriage. Of course, biblical marriage is a man and many women, or a man and a concubine, and or you know, whatever. But in any case, and C, that to prevent conception from happening is a violation of how things are supposed to be. Now, this perspective that Rick Santorum is putting forward is, it sounds incredibly radical right now in 2011. But ask somebody who was, and, you know, we're talking about people in their 60s and 70s. You'd have to find, you know, an old folk person. Ask somebody, old folk, somebody in their 60s, 70s or older, ask them what it was like in the United States. In 1965, the United States Supreme Court decided a case. It was called Griswold versus Connecticut. Now, in 1965, in the state of Connecticut, it was illegal for a married couple to have condoms in their bedroom. It was illegal for a married couple to have condoms in their bedroom or any kind of birth control device. This was just a couple of years after the introduction of the very first birth control pill. And so this was taken to the Supreme Court. And this is there's really quite a history to this. Tillman versus Allman and Poe versus Allman. But in any case, the Griswold versus Connecticut. And there were two justices who actually said, no, this, you know, one was Potter Stewart. He said, you know, the law is crazy. Actually, his phrase was an uncommonly silly law. But he said it's constitutional. States can make such laws. In other words, he was agreeing with Rick Santorum. And Hugo Black said there's no right to privacy in the Constitution. And the other seven justices said, wait a minute, for the state to say that we can kick in your door and come into your bedroom while you're having sex and see if you're wearing a condom, and if you are, arrest you, and you're married and this is your home, that's a violation of your right to privacy. And Justice Hugo Black said there is no right to privacy in the Constitution. So I just wanted to riff on that a little bit. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution does not use the word privacy. And there's a reason. Let me just share with you. This is the amendment to the Constitution that most people say is what confers on us a right to privacy, which would include the right to have condoms in your bedroom. The right, Amendment 4. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, which frankly I think today includes anything that has to do with your computer, your internet, your email. But anyway, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, the only time that right of the people to be secure is the word that they use, in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. The only time that right shall be violated is if a warrant is issued supported by oath or affirmation. In other words, somebody swears and particularly that there's probable cause that a crime is being committed, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the person or things to be seized. In other words, it has to be very specific. Now, why didn't they use the word privacy? Why'd they use the word security or secure? Well, here, it's a very simple answer. In 1787, or 1789, when the final you know, draft of the Bill of Rights was put together in 1791, as I recall, it was finally ratified. At that time, the late 18th century, the word privacy had a different meaning than it does today. The word privacy back then meant toilet functions, going to the bathroom. People would say, if they were excusing themselves from the room to use the bathroom, they would say, excuse me, I need a moment of privacy. And everybody understood that that meant that they need to go to the outhouse or to the room in the house where the bowl, the commode was kept, or the bucket. And in fact, they referred to these rooms, these toilet function rooms, not as bathrooms back then, because the bath was in a completely different room, because the room that held the bucket, this was before indoor plumbing, the room that held the bucket smelled pretty badly. So it was just a little tiny room with a bucket with a seat over it and a board on top of it to keep the smell in. And the bathroom was a separate room where people had a bath and no toilet functions. But the room that held the toilet stuff was called the privy, as in privacy. And it wasn't until 100 years later, in the 19th century, when the flush toilet was invented and indoor plumbing started getting installed pretty much everywhere, and Thomas Crapper got credit for inventing the flush toilet. There's a big debate about that, and most people say he didn't invent it. He popularized it. He sold it. He was one of the first retailers, whatever. But that's why it's called the Crapper, and after Thomas Crapper, in lore, in any case. It wasn't until that time that we stopped referring to toilet functions and what we, you and I, call bathrooms, or the Europeans call water closets, as privies. So the reason there's no right to privacy in the Constitution is because had they written in the Fourth Amendment the right to persons to have privacy in their homes, papers, possessions, and person, would have meant the right to use the toilet. And that would have been pretty silly. But nobody has informed Rick Santorum of this, and apparently nobody had informed Hugo Black of that. And, you know, I think this is one of the things that people just, you know, language evolves. And, you know, most people are just unaware of. So, anyhow, Rick Santorum wants to roll us back to pre-1965, pre-Griswold versus Connecticut, and allow states to ban birth control, because he doesn't believe that the right to use birth control in your own home, in your own bedroom, with your own spouse or friend, is constitutionally protected as a right of privacy. And this is a guy who calls himself a small government conservative, who believes that the states should be able to pass laws that the police can barge into your room while you're having, into your bedroom while you're having sex, and determine whether or not you're wearing a condom or your partner is. You know, call me old fashioned or whatever, but I think Rick Santorum is nuts. Yeah, so we'll see how it goes. Joe in Casper, Wyoming. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm calling with a bizarre request for Democrats.
Okay.
To vote for Ron Paul during the upcoming caucuses and primaries. And I know this is a repulsive idea to vote for a Republican, but I think Ron Paul would be the least repulsive. And if he should beat Obama, he would be the least repulsive for Democrats to accept.
Well, here's the problem. He would never beat Obama because, for example, Ron Paul believes in absolute free trade. In other words, there should be, for all practical purposes, no national boundaries. Immigrants should be allowed to go in and out of any country under any circumstances, and free trade should exist without any limitation whatsoever. Which,
okay, well,
you know,
well, this alone then would, instead of being a pro Ron Paul or Republican, would be a pro Obama, because you would be cutting off Romney, you'd be cutting off Gingrich and Santorum or any of them from even running against him.
Well, and the institutional Republican Party is going to keep Ron Paul out. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And the question.
Well, they're going to try.
Yeah. No, they're going to do it. They're going to do it. They have the ability to do it.
Well, if they can, then maybe that'll bring to surface how crooked the system really is.
Yeah. Or how hidebound it is. I think that the Libertarian, the Ron Paul faction, is banging up against the Republican Party the same way the progressives are banging up against the Democratic Party right now. And on both sides, it's actually a good thing. I wouldn't do the crossover vote thing that you're suggesting, but I know a lot of people are doing it, Joe. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, Citizens United has a possible loophole? We'll get into that right after this. Welcome back to the program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Don't think so. No way. Not going to go there. I find this absolutely fascinating that the Montana State Supreme Court found a loophole in Citizens United and said, you know, where Citizens United said that in order to stifle the, quote, free speech rights of rich people and corporations, a state must find a compelling interest. And so the state of Montana says, the Supreme Court says, okay, you want a compelling interest? Here's a list. It's amazing. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Talk Radio News brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Tell Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Hey, Victoria.
Happy New Year of the Dragon.
Of the Dragon? Is this the Chinese New Year happen at the same time?
No, but I'm just being prescient.
I see. Okay, well, thank you.
Yes.
And Happy New Year to you, too.
You, too.
Are you in? It looks like you're in the White House.
I'm in the basement.
Of the White House.
I'm back, baby.
Okay, so you're back. So what's going on?
Well, I just came from the White House press briefing. Now I'm going to cough myself to death.
Oh, my.
Which is not good. I just came from the White House press briefing, and one of the first questions was, how is the president going to follow the Iowa returns?
Right.
Not a big TV watcher, we're told, although he was watching Homeland, which if you didn't watch it, you should have done, Tom. And we were told that he's no more nor less interested in the results of the Iowa caucuses than anybody else, to which there was an incredulous intake of breath, and everybody went, no more nor less? Really?
That's because he knows, like anybody with 3 ounces of political sense knows, from day one, that Mitt Romney's going to be the nominee.
Going to be likely the nominee, but not necessarily the winner tonight.
No, of course not.
And it might be Rick Santorum.
Or, wow. But see, the winner tonight, this is basically a straw poll tonight, because that there's still a process that the party in Iowa has to go through to convert that vote tonight into actual delegates.
Right.
And they can change things so that Rick Santorum could win the vote tonight, but not get the majority of the delegates.
Exactly. Exactly.
So the Republican Party has got
funky process.
Right. The Republican Party's got the system gamed in Iowa. So this is really, you know, bread and circus. But why do you say Santorum might win tonight?
Well, because it's very tight. There have been 3 polls, Des Moines Register, PPP, and the Insider Advantage that came out last night. And they've got them really within about 3 points of each other, which is margin of error.
Yeah.
And the conservatives who are like Santorum, the Pat Buchanans and the Mike Huckabees, have statistically, from what I've been reading, performed better.
Right.
In Iowa,
right.
Then they have polled.
Right, because there's a very, very activist, fundamentalist Christian base.
Right.
I was just sharing with our listeners and viewers in the previous segment about how Rick Santorum last night on ABC News said that he has no problem with states outlawing contraception. And in
one
fact,
of my
he's,
stories, yes.
Yeah, he said, one of the things I will talk about, no president has talked about before, is I think the dangers of contraception in this country. It's not okay. It's a license to do things in the sexual realm that is counter to how things are supposed to be.
And he has talked about this between married couples.
Yes. So we're talking about going back to Griswold versus Connecticut, 1965, when the Supreme Court ruled that a married couple could legally have condoms in their bedroom. and undoing that.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yeah, and he also said, a friend of mine pointed this out to me last night, I'd forgotten this, that he said when he was a senator that there was absolute proof that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Interesting. I wonder where he got that proof.
Well, somewhere nobody else did.
Yeah, apparently.
So he's got a record. So if he does do well, this is going to come out. It's worth reading Dana Milbank's column on him today in the Washington Post, which of course is snarky. But Milbank's been writing about him since the early 1990s when he was a rookie reporter.
Hmm.
And he was in that area and was assigned to him, and he knows him well.
Interesting.
So that's very interesting. So we've got that. So we've got the politics of place. We've got who shows up. We've got the politics of weather, which is not going to be bad. It's going to be cold and clear, likely. We've got the politics of turnout. And then we've got who comes in fourth, which is very important because you've got Rick Perry and possibly Newt Gingrich, although Newt could surprise everybody, particularly after his, Mitt's a liar remark this morning, which I paraphrased, but that's what he said. He said that Mitt Romney is a liar.
Yeah. In fact, clip number six, Jacob, if you could play that, it's only 15 seconds. Well, if you can quickly get it. You got it?
You're calling Mitt Romney a liar.
Well, you seem shocked by it. Yes. I just think he ought to be honest with the American people and try to win as the real Mitt Romney, not try to invent a poll-driven, consultant-guided version that goes around with talking points. And I think he ought to be candid.
So.
Yeah. He's been very frank. And if he had done this 3 weeks ago, he might not be in the trouble that he's in now.
What do you mean?
I think that he made a number of mistakes early on, but the more recent mistakes, I think, for Newt Gingrich are that he's continued to run a positive campaign in a particular campaign that's been negative, and that he has failed to fight back, and so that he's left things out there about him, some of which have been true and some of which have been twisted, hanging in the wind, and in politics that's meant that they've stayed true.
Uh-huh.
And I think that Gingrich is at his most effective when he's fighting.
Yeah, so he made the same mistake that John Kerry made when he didn't go after the Swift voters early on.
Yes.
Yeah, very interesting.
And he's been Romney-boated, as he himself called it.
Romney-boated. Okay. So what else is going on in the world, Victoria, in 30 seconds?
The Taliban has opened up a Qatar office in a step towards peace talks. It's a peace mission office.
Oh, interesting.
Today.
Is this like a movement like the IRA 30 years ago kind of thing?
Potentially. If it really is, it's a sharp reversal of its long-standing denials that it's involved or interested in negotiations to end its insurgency. But it may be a move, yes. It is a specific peace mission.
Fascinating. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Half of the concealed weapon carry permit holders with felony convictions in the state of North Carolina get to keep their permits. Or so it turns out. Ian Millhiser, doing the research on this story for the Center for American Progress, that basically people commit gun crimes and they get to keep their permits. Now, this isn't the law. It's just the failure to enforce it. But I find it fascinating. I find the whole thing fascinating, and I'm guessing that it's probably going to get amped up as we go into this election cycle, even though the Democratic Party and the president in particular have made no statements about tightening down on regulations of guns. In fact, if anything, the opposite. The NRA has been raising money like there is absolutely no tomorrow. Noel Flasterstein is with us. He's an attorney, gun rights advocate, and general counsel for the Second Amendment Club. The website is gunrightsforyou, FORUYOU.com. Noel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, some history here. The In 1787, when James Madison sent the first draft of the Constitution to his mentor, Thomas Jefferson, who was then the envoy to France and Paris, Jefferson sent him back a letter on December 20th, 1787, talking about all the things he liked about the Constitution. And then he said, "I will now tell you what I do not like. First, the omission of a Bill of Rights, providing clearly and without aid of sophism for freedom of religion, freedom of the press, protection against standing armies." And then he goes on, restriction of monopolies, the eternal and unremitting force of the habeas corpus laws and trials by jury in all matters of fact, triable by the laws of the land and not by the laws of nations. So he wanted there to be a constitutional amendment that forbade standing armies during times of peace. In other words, there would be a citizens' militia during times of peace, like, for example, Switzerland has. And then I refer you to the 1776 Pennsylvania Constitution, on which our Second Amendment was patterned. And Article 8 of the Constitution of the State of Pennsylvania, which all of the founders, of course, were quite familiar with, several of them being from there, quote, that the people have a right to bear arms for the defense of themselves and the states as standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty. They ought not to be kept up, and that the military should be kept under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. So it's fairly clear that at the founding of this country, the founders believed that, or there was a debate, actually. The compromise was they took out the no standing armies and they left in the well-regulated militias and people having the rights to have guns. How did that, over the last, I don't know how many years it's been, get transmorphed or muted into some belief that people have an absolute right to have guns the way that they have an absolute right to, well, do people have a right to drive a car?
Do people have a right to drive a car? Well, in our system of laws, yes. Do people have a right to own firearms? In our system of laws, yes. Do people have a God-given right to drive a car? I don't think so. But do people have a God-given right to defend themselves, which I think this translates in the ability to arm themselves with firearms? Well, then clearly, I think many of the founding fathers would agree. I would interpret this as some of their thinking that we, as individual Americans, and this is what separates us, and Madison so clearly noted, I believe it's Federalist Number 56, may have the number incorrect, but one of the things he recognized that separated America from the kingdoms of Europe, as you refer to them, is that our government, which was supposed to be made by the people, of the people, for the people, by the people, entrusted its citizenry with firearms. Now, I personally believe that, most people...
Well, it wasn't just firearms. Madison talked about militias, citizen militias. These guys are very clear. And, in fact, in most communities where there were citizen militias, the firearms were kept in an armory. They were not kept in individual homes.
Well, I don't know about the historical accuracy of your comment, but my understanding of a militia is a citizen army. That's what it is.
That's right.
It's not organized under the government. It's the citizenry,
right.
And in times of need, they get together.
But that's the right of the state to defend itself as expressed by its individual people. And, of course, the Pennsylvania Constitution says individuals have the right to defense, too. But there have to be some rational limits on that, just like the right to drive has rational limits. You have a right to transportation. I would say you have if you want to talk about God-given rights, a God-given right to transportation, you've got 2 feet. And so can you extend that right to transportation with mechanical devices like a car? Well, apparently we have the right to drive, although it's limited. You have to demonstrate that you know how to drive. You have to demonstrate that you haven't killed anybody driving, that you're not a regular drunk driver, those kinds of things. So you have the right to defend yourself. Do you have the right to defend yourself with your fist? Of course. Do you have the right to defend yourself with a mechanical instrument, a knife, a gun? Maybe. It depends on the circumstances. Do you have the right to defend yourself with a tank? I mean, what if you think that the community, just over the river is representing a threat to you? Do you have a right to have surface-to-air missiles?
Again, most people think our government has 3 branches of government, that being the executive referring to the presidency, the legislative referring to the House and Senate, and, of course, the judiciary. Now, I submit that our founding fathers and mothers designed us to have 4 branches of government, and that 4th branch being us, the people. And what gives us our checks and balances on the other three branches is our right to vote. And what gives our right to vote any meaning, any substance, as recognized by our founding fathers and mothers, is our Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Because if the judiciary or the legislative or the executives aren't going to recognize our votes, aren't going to recognize our will, we have a defense against them, and that's the ability to arm ourselves, which without this belief that the citizen has the right to arm himself, we wouldn't exist. We would have been overrun by the tyranny of Britain.
Respectfully, Noel, I'm sorry, I called you Neil. It's Noel. Respectfully, there is, I challenge you to find any historical basis for that. The founders at length, particularly in Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, at length talked about the need to have a militia that would defend our nation against other nations. Nobody was talking about the citizens being able to rise up against the government that they themselves were creating. Nobody.
Look at the Declaration of Independence, where Thomas Jefferson eloquently notes when the rights of the governed are being trounced by the government, that the government have the governed, that us, the people, have the right to dispose of that government.
Yes, he was speaking.
Our whole country was founded on that concept.
He was speaking of the government of England. You will find no place where any of the founders spoke of their hope that someday citizens, or their fear even, that someday citizens may have to use weaponry against the government that these guys themselves created. It's a fantasy.
Respectfully, just look at the Declaration of Independence where
against the British.
Well, what's the difference between the British government if it's tyrannical or the American?
The British
government
was a kingdom. The American government is a democracy.
We are a republic. We are not a democracy.
Okay, I'll use your word. We are a republic. The British government was a kingdom.
Correct. And to make sure that the republic, that's why we had our great, we got to remember the American experience, which is still going on today, our founding fathers and mothers didn't have a point of reference. They didn't say, let's copy Luxembourg or let's copy.
Actually, they did. They were copying the Greeks, the Romans, and the Iroquois. And they said so.
But they didn't have one specific nation to copy like many of the countries of the world today have to copy. And what separates us is, I think, the true genius of our founding fathers.
But nobody ever suggested in the early days that the right to vote would be enforced by my showing up at the polls with a 45 on my hip.
If the government ignores the will of the governed, as noted by Jefferson, again, I'll refer to the Declaration of Independence, then we have the right to defend ourselves against that government. And that's the
I get it that that's the militia point of view, but I think that, you know, we have the right to take over our political party. Okay, Noel, we're out of time. Gunrightsforyou.com. You can read more about Noel's thoughts. Thank you, Noel.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, this is going to be an interesting campaign year, and we'll see if gun rights come into it. I guarantee you they probably will because, as I said, the NRA is raising money like there's no tomorrow right now. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Laura in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Laura, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
I know how much you like to talk about NLP and stuff like that and how we're programmed in Frank Luntz's worldview of our government. Well, I thought about, like the guy who's talking about the carrying a gun and our gun, rising up against our government, et cetera.
Yeah.
Well, he has so objectified ourselves, our government,
right.
He thinks it's a foreign occupation or something. One simple thing we can do is instead of just saying the government all the time, which we always do, it seems like, we should start saying our government and
well
try
said.
To de-objectify it.
Well said. Well said. And reclaim it.
And reclaim it as ours.
Yeah, in our language. Very well said.
Participants.
Yeah, I thought it was ironic that he was making that argument, and then in the same breath he was saying it's a republic, which is our government. Laura, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Thank you, and thanks for listening. Evan in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Evan, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you, Evan?
Well, I'm hoping to get better, too.
Okay.
I think I might have come up with a potential inherent unconstitutionality with Citizens United. Now, just to let you know, I'm 39 years old. I have Asperger's syndrome. And I think your 100 on our farmer's world is, it's absolutely dead on. I use that all the time as an example to people. Just say, hey, watch this video and you'll get an idea of what it's like to sit in a cubicle for 8 hours a day.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So anyway, back to Citizens United. So just applying some mathematical logic here, we say that humans, as far as I know, every human that's out there could potentially own a corporation. I know you own several. I've had some. But humans own corporations, right? Either corporations, but you trace it back up, eventually human does, right? So corporations are people, and humans own corporations. Don't humans own people? And doesn't that mean we have legal slavery again?
Yeah, well, let me make it even more explicit. Back prior to the 1890s in the charter mongering era, most states outlawed a corporation buying another corporation. But now it's legal for a corporation to buy another corporation. So just on its face, forget the people part of it, the human part of it. If a corporation is a person and it buys another corporation or it owns another corporation, isn't that a violation of the 13th Amendment, which explicitly forbids any person from owning another person? So, I think you've nailed it, Evan. Among others, I mean, there's a whole bunch of very clear insanities to the logic of Citizens United. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate the call. Well said. Larry in Kalmar, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
I think it's going to be a wild and crazy year.
It is.
But, I was watching this morning on network TV. I think it was Bob Schaefer's, I think, was the anchorman, and some gal. And they were talking to Newt, and Newt saying, if Mitt's the Republican nominee, I'll support him, even though he is a liar. Well, that's all we need is another lying son of a Bush in the White House. I mean, Romney is George's son.
George was actually a good governor. I was a little kid in Michigan when he was our governor, and my dad was active in the Republican political party at that time, and I thought he was a reasonably good governor. He came back from Vietnam and said, they tried to brainwash me. We shouldn't be having this war. That destroyed him politically, but he was an honest man.
Yeah.
I can't say the same for his son.
Mitt flip-flops more than Kerry ever did. I mean, it's just crazy to compare even the two of them. But I think the big surprise is tonight here in Iowa, we're going to elect Ron Paul. Ron Paul's going to come away with flying colors.
Okay, so you're in Kalmar, Iowa. So you and I'm assuming you have a TV set. So you probably see all the commercials that are happening. Are they?
Oh gosh, yeah. The phone calls and
you're getting robocalls and people knocking on your door and everything else. Has it become just like gruesomely negative in the last week? Are the stories that we're hearing true?
It's pretty negative. I mean, a lot of the Ron Paul has gone negative, and I think that's the thing that Newt didn't do was go negative, and it burned him.
Paying the price for it.
He's paying the price, but I mean, I thought we gave Newt the boot back in '99, and
yeah, we did.
Santorum in '07, and we didn't. Romney ran in '04, and
against Kennedy and lost. Every single one of these guys has lost. Santorum lost a Senate race. Mitt Romney lost a Senate race. Newt Gingrich lost a House race. Well, actually, he resigned in disgrace. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. Thanks for go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I think Ron Paul, if he did, the Republicans would never have him. I mean, they'll rig the election again or whatever they got to do to make him not. But I think it'd be real interesting if he would get into the presidency. I think
and he comes into the presidency and he says, okay, there will be no more prosecution of illegal aliens because we don't recognize national boundaries or borders with regard to persons or business. There will be no more tariffs. So total free trade. Any country can come to the United States. We're going to decriminalize pot and prostitution and heroin, and which all those things actually make sense to me. But the idea that, absolute
free trade.
No more public education, we're going to close all the public schools, we're going to close all the public roads and turn them into toll roads, we're going to sell off all the public buildings to private corporations, government can rent them. I think that Americans would be shocked if they understood the real, you know, the real essence of the libertarian platform.
Oh, you're definitely right.
Yeah, that Ron Paul has stood on for all these years. And what astounds me is the number of young people who don't have any idea, you know, Ron Paul's real positions. They just know that he thinks that pot should be decriminalized and he's against our foreign wars, you know, which are reasonable positions. But anyhow, Larry, thank you for the call. Thanks for the eyes and ears on the ground there in Iowa. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. To James Madison. Amazing. Oh, coming up next, The Good, the Bad, and the Insanely Ugly.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I like much the general idea of framing a government which shall go on of itself peaceably without needing continual recurrence to the state legislatures. Jefferson. Up as the good, the bad, and the very, very latently ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, the U.S. Treasury building. Last week, the U.S. Treasury became the oldest building in the world to be certified LEED, L-E-E-D, gold, according to the U.S. Green Building Council. Thanks to an issue ordered by the Obama administration, the Treasury building boasts several new environmentally friendly renovations that increase natural lighting, use energy more efficiently, and foster recycling and conservation programs. All told, the new greener U.S. Treasury building is saving taxpayers $3.5 million a year in lower energy costs. Well done. I say it's also time to put Carter's solar panels back on the roof of the White House again. The bad. The Charlton Public Library. In an egregious case of overreacting, the local library in Charlton, Massachusetts, dispatched a police officer over the weekend to collect an overdue book from a five-year-old. The officer notified the five-year-old and her mother that two of their books were months overdue and had to be returned or paid for. According to local news reports, the five-year-old didn't handle the visit well. She broke down crying, afraid that she was going to get arrested. Again, we're talking about police officers chasing down overdue library books belonging to a five-year-old. Unclear if the library calls on the SWAT team to silence people who aren't keeping quiet. And the very, very ugly, Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader and Boehner backstabber, did an interview with 60 Minutes this weekend and had to be saved mid-interview by his press secretary. When Leslie Stahl pressed Cantor about how even his hero, Ronald Reagan, compromised and raised taxes, Cantor stammered a bit before his press secretary interrupted the interview to say, "That just isn't true and I don't want to let that stand." Actually, it is true, completely true. Reagan raised taxes 12 times while in office. And the fact that Eric Cantor won't even consider it and relies on his press secretary to lie about it in a hard-hitting interview shows just how radical and misleading the Republican Party is today. That's very, very ugly. And in fact, here, this is Eric Cantor, clip number, let's just go through this in order. Clip number 9, first of all, Eric Cantor on 60 Minutes.
Nobody gets everything they want. And so
that's,
you know,
just exactly your image, that you want only what you want.
But it's just, I hope I'm not coming across like that now, because it's just not who I am.
So he's saying he's okay not getting what he wants. Here, clip number 10, Eric Cantor.
It really
so
is.
Are you ready to compromise?
So I have always been ready to cooperate. I mean, if you go back to the
What's
first...
the difference between compromise and cooperate?
Well, I would say cooperate is, let's look to where we can move things forward where we agree. Compromising principles, you don't want to ask anybody to do that. That's who they are as their core being.
And that's where she says, but what about Ronald Reagan? And here back to Leslie Stahl.
Your idol, as I've read anyway, was Ronald Reagan. And he compromised.
He never compromised his principles.
Well, he raised taxes, and it was one of his principles not to raise taxes.
Well, he also cut taxes.
But he did compromise.
Well,
that's not true. I don't want to let that stand.
And at that point, Cantor's press secretary interrupted, yelling from off camera that what I was saying wasn't true.
Make no mistake about it. This whole package is a compromise.
Yeah, there you go. So, tell me, Mr. Cantor. Oh, man, it's incredible. Ralph in Los Angeles, listening on KTLK. Hey, Ralph, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know that fellow that called in about the gun rights and so forth? You know, by his logic, because he was saying toward the end there that the people have the right to have arms, and they, if they don't like the government, they can rise up, like Jefferson said, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But by his logic, then, he said if the government isn't listening to the people, well, when Bush started his illegal war in Iraq and all those hundreds of thousands of people were protesting, by his logic, we could have, what, armed ourselves and gone to the White House and taken Bush out of there and changed the government ourselves? See, that's this kind of overheated rhetoric that the right uses, you know, because, oh, if it's a Democrat, then, yeah, we got to change the government. But if it's a Republican, well, they're okay.
Well, I'm not so sure that it's quite that simple, because the there are people in the militia movement, and they have I've been on their programs on shortwave radio. They've got there's a couple of them on shortwave radio. There's a few that are on the web. There's some that are actually on over the regular over the air stations like you're listening to right now, that are taking the position, and this is the position that was held by Tim McVeigh, for example, and many of his friends in the militia movement, that when the government gets out of control, when the people have lost control of the government, then they have to basically bring down the government, and that they are justified in using violence to do it. And the people who take that position use the Declaration of Independence as their, because it's the only document they can find from that era where the founders actually talked about taking down a government. But the fact of the matter is that the founders never, never tried to take down the British government. They tried to push the British government out of our territory, which is a completely different thing. So, number one, it wasn't an attempt to bring down a government. It was an attempt to end an occupation. They viewed this as occupied territory. So the law logic is fundamentally flawed, because what the founders were saying is that we have the right to use force to stop an occupation, an illegal occupation, and a brutal occupation. And here's our list of particulars, our bill of grievances, and it's all right there in the Declaration of Independence. And then secondly, what you find is that throughout the founding era, and frankly throughout all of American history, no credible statesperson on either side of the aisle, or any side of the aisle, any of the positions, you know, the Federalists, the Anti-Federalists, the Whigs, the Democratic Republicans, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, none of them, nobody has ever taken the position that bringing down, that the reason for the Second Amendment, the reason why the Second Amendment says that the rights of citizens to bear arms shall not be abridged, is so that those citizens can go out and kill government officials. In other words, have a revolt against the government. Nobody takes that position except the extreme fringe of the militia movement. And what that leads to is the kind of thing that you saw in Oklahoma City, in my opinion. And I'm very, very concerned about that. And I think it's something that we all need to aggressively push back on. Because the logic of that, if that were true, if the founders, if even one of the founders, but no, you won't find a single one, but if the founders believed that an oppressive, that if the United States government became oppressive, it is the right, it is the duty of the people, to paraphrase the Declaration of Independence, to overthrow it, then they would not have simply said the right to bear arms. They would have said the right to bear, to own ships of war, which was the highest weaponry of the day, right? And if the courts were interpreting the Second Amendment under those rules, they would say that it is illegal to have laws that stop you from owning mortars or surface-to-air missiles or, you know, small rocket or anything, any kind of, you know, an F-15, right? And the fact of the matter is that only an extreme fringe says, no, I want to have the right to a fully automatic weapon, or I want to have the right to 50 caliber machine guns, or I want to have the right to a half track or a tank. And and it's a dangerous kind of thinking, frankly.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for the call, Ralph. Well said. Grady in Peoria, Arizona. Hey, Grady, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. On the same subject, the courts have stretched the a well-regulated militia to allow concealed carrying. The legislature here in Arizona is reintroducing a bill to allow guns on college campuses.
Yep. This goes back to the Supreme Court. Was it the Miller case? I believe the Supreme Court ruled that there is an absolute right to own a weapon in the found in the Second Amendment.
Well, I'm not familiar with that. I just would like to tie the Second to the First Amendment,
mm-hmm.
that says the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievance.
Oh, that's interesting.
Take that back. The courts have tightened up to allow peaceable demonstrators to be pepper sprayed and dragged off from a peaceable demonstration.
Right.
They seem to hold that amendment to a different standard than the Second Amendment, and that confuses and kind of angers me.
Yeah.
So I was wondering your thought on that, Tom.
Well, it's an interesting point, and you know, the First Amendment is one of my very favorites, and I have to admit that after all these years of reciting it over and over and over again, the word peaceable being in there, it had never occurred to me that the framers might have put the word peaceable in the First Amendment so that nobody would think that in the Second Amendment they were arguing that the right that we had the right to violently overthrow our government. And you just, you know, raised that as a possibility, Grady, and at least in my mind. And I think that, you know, there's probably something to be said for that. That every single word of every one of those amendments and every word in the Constitution was debated at length by people who were very, very, very serious about what they were doing, because they believed that they were going to create a document that was going to, you know, last for posterity. And in fact, this republic has lasted longer than any other so far. And it's, I believe, the Greek Republic might have lasted 300 years, but I'm not sure. But I don't think so. I think that we have outlasted them. But in any case,
well, I just want to thank you for what you do, and a great radio program.
Thank you very much, Grady. I appreciate you. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Peaceably to assemble. That's remarkable. And were the Mayans right? Is 2012 going to be the end of the world? I don't think so.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mark in Birmingham, Michigan, listening on WDTW, right? 1310 a.m.?
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, yeah. What's up?
Hey, you know, I think what's been forgotten in our discussion about what you call corporate personhood and the elections and funding elections is that the framers, the original intent was that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, and that being men of the Enlightenment, the right to spend your money on whatever you want, unhindered by the state, was such a given that according to the historians I've read in the commentary, that's why that the property line was taken out in the pursuit of happiness, because the pursuit of happiness means I can do with my money whatever I want, whether it's supporting Barack Obama or Ron Paul or whoever.
Right. I would submit to you, Mark, that you have been reading the writings of libertarians and other people funded by the Koch brothers and other billionaires. The fact of the matter is that in the Enlightenment era, I mean, there's a kernel of truth in the center of what you're saying, but it has been badly distorted.
That's all I'm saying.
Well, let me go through it here for you. In 1674, as I recall, John Locke wrote a second treatise on government. He was the tutor to one of the British kings, I think it was Charles II. And in that second treatise on government, he referred to life, liberty, and private property, or the right to private property. There was an older British term that he used for private property. And the reason that was a radical notion in 1670s was because prior to that time, the king owned your underwear. The king owned everything. You know, the king owned all the land in the country. If you were to go out and you know, hunt deer on your own property and not pay a tax to the king for the taking the deer, that you could be prosecuted or put in prison, and people frequently were. So this right to private property was a radical right. You're right. 100 years later, in the United States, the right to private property was a given. But the reason why Jefferson put happiness in there and said life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness rather than life, liberty, and the right of private property, the reason he put happiness in there was because these guys really, by this time, you know, 100 years into the Enlightenment, they really genuinely believed that it was possible to create a society where the nature of government and the structure of society could produce happiness for individuals. There are absolute limits on how you can spend your money in the Constitution. And the federal government and state governments are given the power to regulate how you can spend your money. In fact, the Commerce Clause is the most explicit, where it says explicitly that the federal government shall have the right to regulate commerce in among and between the state, the several states. So this idea that somehow happiness has to do with what you own, what you buy, and what you can have is one of the bizarre and twisted notions of libertarianism that comes out of the minds of people who are typically the billionaires who are obsessed on money. And number two,
Don't you think the framers had a much more positive view of commerce and capitalism and the right to private property than we do today? The public square is so poisoned on we men of commerce and property. And I mean, I have a corporation. It's just a little.
You have a corporation that during the founding era would not have had any. It would not have had a fragment of the rights that it has now. In fact, the modern corporate form didn't come into being until after the Civil War.
Go ahead. Discourse in the public square. If you look at Occupy Wall Street, the anti-cap from our president's own mouth, the anti-capitalist rhetoric is so poisoned that
it is rhetoric in opposition to the excesses of unregulated capitalism. Unregulated capitalism can become a cancer, just like unregulated growth in a cell is the definition of cancer.
Yeah, and who regulates the regulators?
We do.
Who regulates
we the people? Like, the first three words of the Constitution.
Frank regulating Fannie Mae. Who regulates Barney Frank and Chris Dodd?
The people who elect them, or the people who don't elect them. And that's the system we've got, and if you don't like it, get involved.
Yeah,
If you don't like it, show up and run for office.
Right.
Have you ever shown up at a local political party and said, I'm here to volunteer?
I've participated in Tea Party rallies.
Well, that's a little different thing. Have you ever said, I'm going to become part of the system and change it from within because I believe in this country?
Well, I do that with the money that I contribute to the candidates that apparently you're somehow this big evil trying to make government smaller to reduce the chances of corruption. As the government gets bigger and bigger, there's more room for corruption. That's why money corrupts.
Yeah, it's a nice slogan, Mark, but it's meaningless. Well,
It's as slogan as your man.
What is corrupting government is the libertarian notion that if you have a lot of money, you should be able to buy politicians. If you have a lot of money, you should be able to buy public opinion. If you have a lot of money, you should be able to buy up all your competition and put them out of business. That's what's corrupting this government.
Look at the field of Republicans. There's many different Republicans. If there's a primary, there was Clinton versus
The only guy who's serious in the field of Republicans is the multimillionaire who made his fortune using unregulated capitalism to destroy American jobs and send them overseas. You
know, that's private. That's part of freedom.
No, I don't think so.
Part of freedom.
I absolutely agree with Franklin Roosevelt that a necessitous man is not a free man. That if you're unemployed, you're not free. If you're hungry, you're not free. If you're homeless, you're not free. And the founders did too, which is why the word welfare appears twice in the Constitution, general welfare. Anyway, I'll continue the rant tomorrow. Coming up tomorrow, Mark Williams, will the Tea Party accept Mitt Romney? Let's ask a Tea Partier. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you become part of the action. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.